It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, the outgoing artistic director of American Players Theater looks back on his 23 years at the helm of what's been called the best classical theater company in America.
But first, early voting begins today in Wisconsin. It means you have until next Thursday, October 30th at 5 o'clock if you want to cast your vote in the November elections ahead of time.
With recent court decisions over certain elections laws like voter ID making waves, the rules surrounding early elections might be a little confusing.
Here to help us understand the rules of the road to ensure our votes are counted is Kevin Kennedy. He's the director and general counsel for the Wisconsin Government Accountability Board. Kevin, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob. Can I start by correcting you right away?
Please do.
Friday on Halloween, October 31st, is the last day that in-person or early voting will be permitted.
Well, I was confused because I assumed anybody voting on Friday would be in costume.
Well,
sorry, I did have that wrong.
Still count.
Okay. Well, now, give us the basics. How does early voting work?
Basically, early voting, and it's really just a form of absentee voting, is you go to your municipal clerk's office. You fill out a short form saying, I want to vote absentee. You get a ballot. You mark it. It gets sealed in an envelope that you sign, and the election official at the early voting site signs, and it's then delivered it to the polling place on election day and processed just like any other absentee ballot.
Okay, so that's we can do that one stop at the office. We can also still absentee vote by mail. Is that right?
That's right. Now, that's where your Thursday deadline comes in. If you want an absentee ballot mailed to you, and you could have been asking this for weeks now, the last day to ask to have that mailed to you is Thursday, October 30th.
Now, how many places are there where we can vote in person? What kind of places can we go to do this with the early voting?
Well, there's really only one place in each municipality. So there's 1,852 places, but in Madison and Milwaukee, that's one place. The city clerk's office in Madison, and there's an alternate site in Milwaukee at the Zeidler Center right next door to City Hall. But each municipality has one place where it can be done. Our law doesn't allow multiple places. So there are long lines in our larger cities as a result of that. Milwaukee is always busy. I often vote early in Madison because I'm a little busy on election day. So I stand in line. I probably will go do that next week sometime.
Now, wherever we are in the state, is there an easy way to find out where to go to place that early vote?
There is, probably, and it's a good thing to go to for anything election-related, and that is you go to a website that we put together called myvote.wi.gov, and you type in your name, your date of birth. It will tell you what municipality you're in, and you can get the clerk's address. You can also find out, am I registered to vote, so that you're prepared. And you can look at the candidates that are going to be on the ballot, the names of the candidates and referendum questions that will be on the ballot for your election. So it's a nice one-stop place to get a lot of information. And it's not unusual that people, if they're living in a suburban area, they're not quite sure what their municipality is. Their mailing address might be Milwaukee or Appleton, but they might live in one of the adjoining municipalities.
Now, to be very clear, do we need an ID to get a ballot for early voting?
You do not need an ID to get a ballot. If you're not registered, you will have to provide proof of residence and fill out a registration form. That often, the best piece of proof of residence is usually your driver's license if it's current and it has your name and address on it. But you can also use utility bills or property tax statements or rental agreements for that. But that's only if you're not registered or if you're registered at a different address and you need to update your registration.
And the same thing is true, right, if we actually want to vote on election day but haven't registered?
That's correct. Wisconsin is very good about making sure that you're not closed out 20 days before the election or 30 days before the election. We allow you to update your registration or register for the first time either in the clerk's office or at the polling place after we close our regular registration.
Now, you mentioned the deadline for early voting, the end of this month. Can we vote on weekends this year?
No. This is one of the changes. The early voting in the clerk's office is limited to weekdays, and the hours are between 8 in the morning and 7 at night. But a lot of our smaller municipalities may not be open those full set of hours. They may be open because it's a part-time clerk, or they might even be open by appointment. But you can't vote before 8 or after 7 unless you're standing in line at 7 o'clock, and you can't vote on weekends.
Now let's go to some election day voting. I know you just put out a press release today, and one of the bullet points is why we might consider waiting until election day, not voting early. Why is that?
Well, other than when the polls open or about the time everybody's getting off work, election day can be a pretty easy visit. If you show up, you know, say after 9 o'clock in the morning, before 4 in the afternoon, it's not unusual that there's no waiting at all for voting. And if you make arrangements with your employer, you can get time off of work, not guaranteed to be paid, to provide for that convenience. I mean, our early voting process, our absentee vote by mail, and the idea that the polls are open for 13 hours on election day is to provide people with the opportunity to vote.
Now, a point of curiosity, if I do early voting or an absentee vote, how do you then make sure that I don't vote again on election day?
Well, we have a statewide voter registration system where we track whether or not people have voted or cast their ballot. And the municipal clerks mark the poll lists that are used at the polls on election day as whether or not the person has applied for and cast an absentee ballot.
Now, talking about election day preparation on your side of things now, not so much from the voter perspective, with the off-again, on-again, off-again voter ID law, have you had to switch gears since the last time I talked to you and change things for local elections offices now that voter ID is not required?
Yes, we have. No question about it. We've been going forward, going backwards, going forward, going backwards. You know, a lot of it was really trying to make sure that we were eliminating any references to an ID requirement because it gets confusing. We even had a clerk call us the other day, and when we went to call her back, her voicemail said, don't forget to bring an ID to the polls. She had cleaned up her website, but not that. But we had to redo a lot of the materials that we give for training to the poll workers to take out references to ID. For example, people who are unable to enter the polling place because of a disability can have the ballot brought to them in their vehicle. And, you know, before that we had a step in there about ID. We had to make sure we took that out of the instructions.
And there was a question about people who had already gotten absentee ballots before voter ID was reinstated and trying to catch up with what had to happen there. Are those still somehow in limbo now that voter ID is back off?
They're not in limbo. We tried to make sure that they didn't think that it was a wasted effort. We directed the clerks to make sure they sent a letter to the people who had already received an absentee ballot, letting them know that even though we told you that ID was required and your ballot may not be counted, ID is no longer required, and if your ballot is returned, it will be counted with or without ID.
And Kevin can give us another plug for the website where people can go for all that election day, pre-election day info you mentioned earlier.
Myvote.wi.gov.
All right, Kevin, thanks as always for joining us.
You're welcome, Rob.
That's Kevin Kennedy. He's Director and General Counsel of the Government Accountability Board. If you've enjoyed a play, Shakespeare or otherwise, at American Players Theater in Spring Green over the years, you may want to stop and tip your hat to David Frank. He's been at the helm of the company as artistic director for 23 years. The company was in debt and producing 4 productions a year when Frank took over for 2 of the departing founders.
Today, the company is operating in the black, puts on around 9 productions a season, and has been called the best classical theater company in America by the Wall Street Journal.
David Frank is wrapping up his 23rd year at APT with a production of Alcestis. Frank is retiring this month. Brenda DeVita takes over for him as artistic director.
David Frank is with us now to look back on his 23 years with American Players Theater. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, take us back to that first day that you hoofed it up that famous hill at American Players Theater to start the process of applying for artistic director. What do you remember about that day and the first play you saw?
Well, I have a story that I've told so often that I'm afraid that everyone's already heard it, but it is emblazoned in my mind. And that first visit, I was there for Sunday matinee, a matinee. It must have been 95 degrees. It was extraordinarily hot, and the reek from the porta potties was almost visible as it wound its way down towards the expensive seats. And you'd have thought that most human beings would have paid the full price of a theater ticket not to be present. There were 400 or 500 people sitting spellbound to a production of Winter's Tale, from which not one word had been cut. And I thought, this is the most extraordinary phenomenon I have ever seen. It is true, the stage is wobbling, and the premises are fairly primitive, and there's no money in the bank, but what a precious inheritance that was.
And you just come down from a big letdown in not getting that same position, artistic director at Oregon Shakespeare, and there you were at APT with the porta potties and a theater company that needed some TLC. What was it like? What was your mindset going in? Did you feel like you'd been booted to the minors?
Well, you know, no, I really never. I took one look at this place and I thought, oh, I want this job so badly, and felt supremely lucky to get it. It was obvious that there was some, you know, you had to crawl before you could walk, and we had to cut costs and all those kind of things. But it was just Madison, that audience, some of the actors we inherited. It was all so promising, so exciting, so so capable of rapid change. We were just agog to get on with it. There were practical problems, but they were all seemed capable of solution.
Now, you had wanted to be an actor yourself. How did you wind up a director?
I wanted to be an actor for a very short time. I trained long enough to convince myself and everyone else surrounding me that I was not going to be God's gift to the stage. way back in drama school. But by then, the bug had already bitten deeply. And there was a little voice always outside me looking at me going, Frank, you're really bad. And that is a guarantee of a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you know you're bad, you certainly will be. But what was, I just loved looking at what other people were doing and could hardly contain myself from saying, why don't you try? What if we did? Way back from drama school, I thought that's what I want to do. Now I've just got to figure a way of having someone let me do it.
So what were those early years like when you took over? I mean, APT has changed so much over the years. Right. From those first years, you got the job, obviously, as artistic director. What was it like in the beginning for you?
Well, you know, it was insanely exciting and hard work, of course, because okay, every actor is going to be in every show. We've got to cut costs whatever we do, and we've got to produce as many plays, maybe even more. It's the old simple formula, isn't it? Increase income, decrease expense. There was such a response from audiences. There was such a response. The very first thing I remember we did, because there wasn't much money to travel, so you had kind of one audition trip, but we basically went out to a rather fine training program, which, alas, I think doesn't exist anymore, but did at this time. It's one that had its origins in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, then went to Newark, Delaware. And we essentially hired the graduating class of highly trained young actors, non-equity, inexpensive relative to their talent and ability, and seated those with the equity actors, chosen equity actors we'd inherited from the company. So it was really exhilarating, feeling the expansion, getting a sense of the audience that we had inherited, and also the ideas that we had inherited from the founders. That was the critical inheritance, which was that these plays, properly done, in and of themselves, can be exciting to a contemporary audience. They don't need messing up. They don't need, rotating stages and huge, heavy-handed concepts that are essentially making a boring experience more acceptable. If you just do the plays and tell the story well, and above all, make the language clear, they work. And Madison, of course, was the perfect place for that kind of proposition, because it's highly educated, well-read, and there were lots of audience members who came out to see those plays. We had no sets to speak of. Very costumes we largely rented or reused stock if we had it. Borrowed, we'd make a little bit, but not a whole lot. But the basic idea worked, and that was thrilling.
Now, you mentioned language, and you have a reputation for working really deeply with language, with crystallizing the meaning in it and being attuned to that element in particular. How has that bending toward language shaped what APT is?
Well, I think it really has. You know, in a way, I suppose it was a nice byproduct of poverty. When you have nothing else, you have the play, you have the actors, and that play is a story and those words. And that's above all what you have to do. Telling a good story is, of course, common to any production of any play of any kind, but you better do it. And then you have to deal with all those words, those dense verbal texts, which are the specialized area of concern for APT. And I'd always been fascinated with what the potential of adding the kind of rather technical background I came from in terms of verse speaking and phrasing and the mechanics of the voice and the mechanics of verse speaking, along with the kind of spontaneity and excitement and freedom that you detected in American acting. And often you were taught that there was a compromise between the two. You did that or that, and you tried to forge a middle path. And I always thought, no, I want to put it a slightly different way. I don't think it's a compromise. I think you fuse the two, that technical skills, if they are achieved at a high enough order, are actually incredibly freeing because they wither away. If the technique is good enough, an actor isn't conscious of it. They can just play the thought. But then also there was a way of trying to approach the poetry and to... this is getting complex and technical, but it was passionately important to us to try to make an approach to the verse that was specific to us. It doesn't mean it's unique. It's just that's what we wanted to unify the company around. That's why we wanted a permanent company, so that everyone could get on the same page as to how we approach dense verbal text. And the product of it should be that those complex verse becomes necessary, not just pretty, but a vital way of communicating, and that you can share your excitement with the language with an audience right there.
And so
that has been the center for us.
And you've been with this company for 23 years. You must have so many stories about it. I wonder if you have one or two brief stories that are special to you that you'll remember.
Oh my gosh, you know, you never know. what story? Well, I mean, it was one of the early ones I remember here, because I was asked that question quite some years ago about what the stories you remember first coming here and how was it different from being outdoor, from the indoor theaters that I'd been solely occupied in before. And I remember an early rehearsal of A Midsummer Night's Dream outdoor, and we were rehearsing on the stage. We didn't have many other places. It was a very hot afternoon, even in June, and we were rehearsing. And that Val Lance, wonderful actress, she got married and went away and had children and all sorts of other career things, but she was a terrific actress, loved her, and she was playing Helena. And the scene called for her to be lying down in the woods, which was on the stage. And we got to the end of that scene, and I said, okay, hang on, let's gather for a moment and talk that through. And Val was still lying there. And then there was a squawk from Val, and her plastic earring had melted and bonded to the
Oh, no.
But that wasn't the surprising thing. What was surprising was everyone took it in their stride as if it happened the whole time.
Wow. Oh, my gosh.
They quickly cleared it. Oh, that's old hat, David. You haven't seen anything yet.
Wow. So lots of things happening at APT that you could probably fill a book with it. And, you know, we only have a little bit of time left here, a few seconds. Is there a Shakespeare line about goodbyes that comes to mind as you prepare to leave?
Oh, you know, I haven't prepped that one. There's so many lines, aren't there? But hopefully it's not a real good. You know, I'll be back to do a show next year, just one show, and I'll be around in the background in my walker urging on. There is a...
And I'm sorry, we're out of time. I have to leave it there, David, but it's been a pleasure to talk with you, and I wish you luck. David Frank is the outgoing artistic director of American Players Theatre. We're launching another round of candidate forums today. Over the next 2 weeks, we'll be talking with the candidates in a variety of races around the state to help you make an educated vote on November 4th.
And we start with the race for governor. Well, it's mainly being described in the media as a battle between incumbent governor Scott Walker and challenger Mary Burke, the Republican and the Democrat. There are two third-party candidates on the ballot, giving voters an alternative choice to the major political parties.
We'll talk to both of those candidates over the next hour, beginning with Dennis Fehr. He's the People's Party candidate for governor, a party that he founded, and he owns a painting company in the Chippewa Valley. He joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Dennis, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you. Nice to have me. Nice to be here.
Thank you for being here. Well, Dennis, we're going to start with the question that we always do, which is, why are you running for governor?
Well, I'm running for governor here because, you know, over the past years as I've been running my painting company, I've really become a lot more in tune with the politics here in our state and around the country. And what I found is that the Republican and Democrat Party are really failing to address a lot of the needs of the people here in our state. So this election, I decided that if I wouldn't be able to find anybody else reasonable to vote for, I would found my own party, and we would go about doing that, running and meeting the needs of the people with the People's Party.
You're a young guy. You're new on the Wisconsin political scene. Tell us a little bit about yourself and about your background.
Well, I tell you what, I'm 24 years old. I grew up here on a hobby farm in Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin. I studied manufacturing engineering and business management at UW-Stout, and I've been running a painting company here now for about 4 years. So I do a lot of traveling all over the state, doing estimates and working for different customers here and there. Politics has really become something that was interesting to me because I can really see that we need a new vision for going forward here in our state. And, I think we need somebody that can see both sides of the aisle and work towards pragmatic solutions to get problems fixed.
As you said, you're the founder of the party that you're representing, the People's Party. Can you tell us why you started that party a bit more, and more specifically, what it stands for, what the platforms are?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, when we went about founding the People's Party, what we wanted to do is we wanted to bring together the best ideas all across the spectrum. As I see it, we have Democrats and Republicans right now in power, and both parties have very good ideas, along with a lot of the other third-party candidates and parties around our country. But what they fail to do is bring together the best ideas to represent the needs of the people. They tend to put their party first. So what we did is we brought in a lot of the financial points off the Republican platform, the social issues off the Democrat platform, and a variety of other issues that we've developed or we've brought in from all other areas of the country. We have a 5-point plan that begins to address the needs, both financial and social. And those start off, our first point on there is what we call smart government initiatives. It would implement technology into our state's infrastructure to increase the efficiency of the way the government operates. I can run my entire painting company off of an iPad, and when we go into the DMV, I think it's kind of a shame that we have such long lines and are still filling out paper copies. So that's our first initiative to make
our
government more efficient.
Let's stick with that one for a moment. You want to modernize the technology throughout the government agencies in order to increase efficiency, to save money. Of course, mm-hmm. doing that costs money. How would you plan on funding that, and how would that work?
Well, you know, it's just like a manufacturing company. Sometimes it costs a little bit to have process engineers or lean manufacturing engineers come into the plant. But what they find is that more often than not, they're able to work out so many of the kinks and areas that have been costing their company, or in our situation, our state, tons of money, that in the long haul, it's definitely worth it. In the meantime, we can do a variety of things. We're going to talk about legalization a little later on our platform. But essentially, saving the costs from an inefficient government will go a very long ways in paying back any of the money that we would need to make that happen in the first place.
It's possible that the next governor will face a budget shortfall on day one of being governor. What actions would you take to get the state's fiscal house in order?
Well, one of the points on our platform is legalization of marijuana. Now, on there we have 3 points. We stress the industrial, recreational, and medicinal uses. Here in our state, we have a very large agricultural industry, and hemp actually used to be one of Wisconsin's agricultural products up until World War II. We were one of the largest producers of hemp. Now, the hemp is actually able to be manufactured into biodiesel fuels, plastics, clothing, a whole array of products. And I think it's an industry that we can grow here first, and we can make millions and billions of dollars off of tax revenue, very similar to what Colorado and Washington State have already done, except they have only stressed the recreational and medicinal uses. The industrial applications will actually have a much greater impact on our state's financial well-being than either of those combined. And I think that's one thing that we can do immediately and really start bringing that money in to help fund things like our roads or our schools, a lot of different programs.
And looking at budget issues overall and the job situation here in Wisconsin, jobs are shaping up to be election issue number one. And How do you plan on creating jobs in the state?
Running a painting company, you know, I realize it's really not as difficult to create jobs as it's made out to be. Our second point on our platform is actually tax reform. And one of the things that we've done is we brought together a bunch of people from all across the spectrum, colleges, all across the state to help revise the tax code. Right now, our tax code is extremely complicated, and it is inhibiting businesses from entering into our state. One thing that we can do to bring more businesses and jobs here is simplify our tax code. How we would plan on doing that is combining the progressive system that we have today with a flat tax system. So we have the progressive tax, and we're still bringing in enough money to fund the state and our programs, but we have the simplicity of a flat tax. Now, what that's going to do is that's going to save businesses all around the country that are looking to come to the state of Wisconsin to do business and provide and grow jobs here. It's going to save them money and time in filing their taxes and dealing with the state, so they would be more apt to come here. That would give them incentive to come to Wisconsin first and grow. I think that is a very good plan in creating the jobs here that we need.
So specifically, you think reforming the tax code will stimulate job creation in Wisconsin?
Well, absolutely. When you have a very simple tax code, when you have initiated a smart government and you've actually reduced the cost of the infrastructure and you've made it easier to adhere to the laws and regulations in the state of Wisconsin, you've improved the business environment for our state. And you've not only done it in the business environment, but you've done it in a professional and personal environment as well. So you not only have businesses that want to come here, but you have people that want to come here and work and live and raise their families. So the tax code plays a major part in which companies go to which states. Now you'll notice that Solar City and is building a new plant, or I guess, sorry, it's not Solar City, but Boeing moved their plant here from Washington State, or they were considering it. The taxes were a big part in that. Tesla is building the world's largest battery plant. I believe they picked Nevada to build that in. You know, these are all big industries that Wisconsin can capitalize, and the tax code, the smart government, these things will help bring businesses here. It's high-tech manufacturing jobs that we need to capitalize here first to bring our jobs in, and I think that's one way we can do that.
We're talking right now with gubernatorial candidate Dennis Fehr, who's running as a member of the People's Party. If you've got a question for Dennis or you're wondering where he stands on an issue, give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Today and tomorrow on the show, we're talking with the candidates running for governor here in Wisconsin. We've got Dennis Fehr with us now. He's the People's Party's candidate for governor. And if you've got a question for him, you can join us.
Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What issue do you want to ask the candidate about? What's important to you in this race that you'd want to get his take on? Again, 800-642-1234. Or you can email talk@wpr.org.
And Dennis, we had a caller who couldn't stay on the line, Brad from Appleton, who asked, would eliminating or reducing taxes help create jobs? They tried it in Kansas, and that state has been among the slowest in creating jobs.
Well, what we've done is not just eliminate the taxes. We've actually revised the entire system and the collection process that goes along with it. So just removing some loopholes isn't going to incentivize businesses in the way that we would do that. What we would really like to do is completely overhaul the system and make it much simpler and easier. There's only a few states in the country that actually have a system as simple as a flat tax, and many of them do see the benefits from that. It is a very, you know, it's an interesting thing to kind of look at. Tax reform is something that we've been trying to get done since Reagan, and I think it's time that we really take a serious look at how we can incentivize the businesses. I know personally that I run a business, and the tax code is very complicated, and my business is small in comparison to very large ones, so they also see the negative externalities along with a complex system, and I think it will definitely bring in more businesses.
We go to another caller now. Bill joins us from Madison. Hi, Bill.
Oh, hello. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Yeah, taking my call. Just a quick question for Mr. Speer. If I heard correctly, a few minutes ago, he said, talking about the tax plan they have, that he wanted to combine the progressive and the flat tax and get the virtues of both. But that sounds to me like, that sounds like tall but short.
Right. Is it contradictory, Bill is asking, to be both progressive and flat when you're looking at taxation?
Well, that's a very good question, Bill, and I appreciate that. You know, it's very hard to explain a complex tax system or any tax system for that matter without kind of a nice whiteboard to take a look at. And it is a little bit contradictory. However, once you get looking at the numbers, you'll see that once you've flattened out the tax brackets, you can actually continue with a progressive system. But the flat tax aspect of our system is simply in having a flat bracket, so that way you don't have as many deductions or credits. Them are what really make our system that we currently have very complex. So by eliminating all of those and going to a flat bracket system, you can still have it progressive tax along with that. It just simplifies the progressive brackets. And there's a few other things that we've done. Like I said, through the collection process of those taxes and how it's actually been implemented, that would also help to keep it progressive and very simple. It's kind of hard to explain over radio without having the opportunity to actually show you visually. That's something that we're working on right now on our website so people can get a much better feel for it.
And thank you, Bill, for that call at 800-642-1234. You can join us at 800-642-1234 with your question for Dennis Fear. And another issue that has been prominent over the past several months and years has been the minimum wage. Would you support or oppose raising the minimum wage in Wisconsin?
Well, the minimum wage is a very interesting question to look at. And the problem that I see with it currently is that raising the minimum wage, as the Democrat Party would suggest, doesn't actually fix the fundamental problems associated with having a reduced buying power. Now, if you study economics quite a lot, what you'll find is that due to the reduced buying power from inflation, that's why we want to increase the minimum wage. There, the Democrat Party does. How I would prefer to address this is by reducing the amount of money that the federal government has injected into our tax or into our currency. This way, it will increase the amount of money that the amount that the money is worth. This would actually allow us to essentially raise the minimum wage without having to pass a law to raise the minimum wage physically. This is called quantitative easing when they print money in economics, and it causes a lot of the inflation that we've seen with our current system, and it's something that we need to be able to regulate the federal government on. Our tax system also will allow us to do this through the implementation process of the collection of the taxes. That's one of the other big aspects in it. By changing the way that we've brought in the taxes from the state, we can then change the way that the federal government is paid. And that will allow us to have the power to tell the federal government that they're not allowed to print money and artificially deflate our currency. That is the cause of the minimum wage, and if we or the minimum wage problem that we're having right now. And simply increasing the minimum wage will only further drive up inflation. We need to address the problem at its core, and the problem at its core is the quantitative easing that the federal government is doing. We need to find a way to stop that, and I think that is through the tax collection process.
Let's take another call now. Dan is with us from Dallas. Hi, Dan.
Hello.
Hi, Dan.
Yes, I'm calling, wondering if you have any ideas about incentives for the industrialization use of hemp.
Okay, so, thank you, Dan. Any incentives for industrialization? You wanted to legalize marijuana to bring jobs and money into the state. What's your plan in specific?
Well, that is the first step, is getting it legalized, getting it decriminalized. Right now, our farm bill has in there provisions for hemp, and we need to address them first, obviously, to bring that in. But we have a lot of crop subsidies that would also be affected by this. And the only incentive that we really need is to decriminalize and legalize the hemp, the artificial hemp in our state. You know, farmers will be able to make a lot of money off this. That is what incentivizes them. We can do similar things that Colorado and Washington are doing. Businesses will come in. They will grow simply because they are allowed to do so. And, you know, that is one of the biggest incentives. It's the money behind it. So businesses want to make money, and by allowing them to do their business, we're going to incentivize them. You know, we have to start by making it legal. You know, that's the first step.
And in terms of education, do you envision making significant changes to the state's education budget, and would you support an expansion of charter and voucher schools in Wisconsin?
The charter and voucher schools here in Wisconsin were initially set up in the greater areas, you know, Milwaukee, Madison. I think that we should have more local community control. You know, I went to school in Chippewa Falls, Chi High. Do we need a voucher school program there? I don't think so. There are communities in our state that could use them, and I think that's definitely best to have local control over who needs those subsidies. I would really hate to see, you know, three or four schools and then have them have to divide the amount of money up between them. You know, we want to see better education for our dollar. We shouldn't be so focused on which schools our kids are attending. It is about the education. So I think the local communities know best, and we can allow them to have voucher school programs if they would like to. But really, we need to be pushing for a better education. And like I said, I think the local communities know best, so they'll know if they need the voucher or not. We should leave it up to them.
And another call now. Let's go to Larry joining us in Appleton. Hi, Larry.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. My question would be, because of the fact that there is a growing concern about the increasing inequality of not only income but wealth in our country and in the globe, as a matter of fact, I'm wondering if your tax plan takes anything like that into consideration. Would your tax plan reduce or increase the growing inequality?
Okay, thank you for the call, Larry. Dennis?
Well, what we did when we developed this tax plan, in order to make sure that it works with the numbers that we have currently, we actually set up all of the brackets based on exactly what we have right now to make sure that it is still bringing in the same exact amount of money. Now, what you do to make it equal and fair for everybody is when you're administering which brackets go where, you set it up so that it is equal by the percentage paid in for each bracket. So it actually allows you to keep the same amount of coming in that we have right now, because that's where the numbers were based off of, and yet then once you have that in place, you can set the brackets so that they're fair with everybody. One of the problems with the flat tax system is that it takes a larger percentage of the buying power from the working, from the poor individuals, which is why we actually started our first bracket off at a zero tax bracket, which would mean that essentially our hypothetical first tax bracket, If you were to say from 0 to 25,000, you would call that your 0% bracket. So all of the taxes paid in, if you only made 20,000, you essentially wouldn't pay anything in under that bracket, but you also wouldn't get anything back at the end of the year. It takes out all of the credits and deductions. It also allows for a much simpler system. And when you jump up to your next bracket, it's a higher percentage, and then the brackets thereafter would decrease in percentage. This gives you the incentive to keep growing your business, making the right decisions to do that. It always is about creating a fair system. And when you have a flat bracket with no credits or deductions, it allows you to have much more transparency and essentially equality in your tax system.
Okay, thanks a lot, Larry, for the call. And one more quick call from Don in Lafarge. Hi, Don.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Say, there's a lot about what Dennis is saying that I like. I like the sort of pragmatic approach of looking at what's good from both parties and kind mm-hmm. of picking them and using them, you know. But I have a problem with, I guess, kind of be blunt, voting for Dennis, because right now one of my concerns is I don't like Governor Walker. I'd like to see him out of there. So I feel like if I voted for Dennis or some third-party person, that would be sort of a throwaway vote, because it'd be a vote away from, you know, Burke or, you know, the opponent. And I feel stuck with that. I feel mm-hmm. like I kind of stuck with voting for a rather incomplete plan as opposed to maybe a better plan that Dennis has, just because I don't really feel that, you know, it's almost like a catch-22.
Gotcha, Don. I think we've got the gist of what you're saying. And in our last mm-hmm. moments here, Dennis, how would you respond to that?
Well, I tell you what, I hear that all across the state. And the issue that I really have with that is this. You know, we haven't made any progress in a very, very long time. And that is because we haven't really supported third-party candidates. So is it throwing your vote away to vote for a third-party candidate who has the possibility of really doing something? Or is it throwing your vote away to vote for one of the two main parties that we know will not accomplish anything in the next session or sessions thereafter? That is the reason that we're in the position that we're in. It's not because of third-party candidates. We haven't had the opportunity all across the country to really take lead. It is because of the two-party system, and I would definitely say that by voting for the two-party system, you are essentially voting for the same thing that we have right now, which is gridlock and really not getting anything done. You know, I think we're a better option.
Dennis, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. It was nice to be here.
That was Dennis Fehr. He's the People's Party candidate for governor of Wisconsin. On the other side of the news, we'll talk to the other third-party candidate running for governor, Robert Burke.
And tomorrow at 3:30, Democratic challenger Mary Burke will join us for a candidate forum. We offered Governor Walker an interview on the program. He was unable to join us.
And for more information on all the forums we're hosting over the next 2 weeks, head on over to wisconsinvote.org. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.